This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Owen Suskind looked like a typical toddler until he was almost 3 years old when he seemed to disappear inside himself. He stopped talking, became agitated, and cried inconsolably. His worried parents were told he had a form of regressive autism. And the only thing that calmed Owen down were Disney movies, which he watched obsessively, memorizing hours and hours of dialogue. Owen's family discovered that they could communicate with him through the storylines and characters of The Lion King and Aladdin, Peter Pan, Beauty and the Beast, and unlock the mystery of Owen's inner life. His father, Ron Suskind, tells this remarkable story in his new book, Life Animated. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a senior fellow at Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, and joins us from the studios of Harvard University. And Ron Suskind, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. So how well did Owen teach you to speak Disney?
I am fluent in Disney.
Are you?
Yes, I can do voices. I dance in front of the screen. I know all the lyrics. The whole family does, including his older brother, who is a so-called typical 25-year-old. We all speak it.
You know, I was thinking, having interviewed you and frankly seeing you being interviewed on other programs, either on radio or on TV, you're a guy who likes to talk, you like to communicate. And I kept thinking as I was reading your book about what it must have been like to have a child who lost for a period of time this ability to communicate with others.
I think that's one of those cosmic joke moments. You know, you make your plans and God laughs. It was excruciating to have a child who was there looking at you, often wouldn't look at you, just often is in his own world, who couldn't really communicate with you. That's the heartbreaking part of autism, whether it's the late onset like we have with Owen or kids who have a more traditional profile where it's there at birth, is that you can't talk to them. You can't tell them what they need to hear. You can't answer the questions. You can't say I love you and have them say I love you back. Mm. So it's quite a challenge.
What was Owen like before autism?
He was a pretty chatty 2.5-year-old. You know, I love you guys. Let's get ice cream. Where are my Ninja Turtles? All the things 2.5-year-olds are concerned about. And we didn't see anything. Now, looking back with regressive autism, it's about a third to a quarter of all the kids who are on the autism spectrum, which is now one out of every 42 boys in the United States, which is rather astonishing. This is back in 1993, though, before everyone knew about autism. I mean, mostly what we knew then was Rain Man. That's what most folks know. They saw the movie. And it felt like vanishing, Marty, but of course he's still there. It's not as though he actually disappears. It's just he regresses and he loses function. So from that full 2.5-year-old vocabulary of, you know, 200-300 words, he ends up after a few months down to one word. Juice was his only word, was juice.
And it seemed that even his body movements were changed as a result of this regressive autism.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact is that autism is a pervasive developmental disorder, so it strikes everything. It's pervasive, as they say. So his motor control is off. He's walking around like someone walking with their eyes closed. He's not sleeping, which is something that is startling to a family. You know, we have two boys, and they both were traditional babies. You know, they're up for a while, then they learn how to sleep, and that he seemed to have lost that, too. So we were concerned in ways that just left us mostly terrified and confused. I said, a kid doesn't grow backwards. What could this be? Until Cornelia, my wife, and I finally talked to the first person who said autism.
And what did that mean to you back in 1993?
Well, it meant Rain Man. It was plain and simple. We said this. We basically said our child cannot be Raymond Babbitt, the Dustin Hoffman character. That's just not possible. And it's interesting because you sit down and you hear this word, and you can almost feel your life changing in those seconds. I can see those two people sitting in the doctor's office, my wife and I, now, because even at the moment, it was like you float out of your body and you're looking down on them, frozen in their chairs. And then really a whole new life begins for the whole family. You know, Owen is the one who's whacked, but we all start our change. And the book is largely about not just Owen, but how all of us changed.
Well, interestingly, your book is dedicated to your other son, whose name I thought was interesting is Walt, like Walt Disney.
Right.
I didn't know what to make of that exactly.
Well, after the book came out, you know, folks from Walt Disney said, "My, were you fans early on? You've long been aficionados of Disney." I said, "Well, no, my father was born in 1927. He died when I was a kid. So our first son was going to be named Walt." It might have helped, though, in his relations with his younger brother that he happened to have the holy name of Walt.
And what Owen begins to do is just obsessively watch Disney movies. As you watched him watch, what did you see? What did you observe?
Well, we saw that he was uncomfortable almost everywhere except there. Up in the bedroom in our house in Georgetown, we were renting a house, he seemed settled and at ease. We asked our doctors about it. We had a team of specialists already. And they said, "Look, is he joyful?" We said, "He seems to be." Mm-hmm. "Is he seem comfortable?" "Yes, yes." "So don't cut it off." Well, we said, "Well, all he wants to do when he's not densely scheduled by Cornelia, by my wife, running to every therapist we could find, every doctor, is he likes to watch these movies." And there were the movies he liked, Marty, before the onset of the autism. Every kid loves these movies of this period. I mean, remember, Disney had a couple tough decades and then roars back in 1989 with a movie called The Little Mermaid that was a huge hit. And then Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. These were some of the biggest movies of any movies in those years, and every kid watched them. The difference, though, is after the autism, Owen seemed intently focused, and he would rewind them often and just would stay up there for hours.
And you have this extraordinary event where his older brother Walt is having his birthday, and his younger brother Owen says an incredibly insightful thing to him. Can you recreate that for us?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, you know, Owen is speaking in what's called echolalia, or scripting, up to that point. And autistic parents will know what I'm talking about, where lots of kids on the spectrum memorize scripts or memorize language, though it's believed they don't really understand what those words mean. And there's some evidence that supports that. Echolalia, like echo, like a parrot.
Right.
But Owen seemed to be choosing phrases that had meaning. So we were going back and forth with the doctors. He said, you know, "Beauty lies within." We said, "Well, that's the key phrase of the movie, the one he's repeating. Maybe he knows what the movie's about." Well, we can't tell. Well, he's about 6 and a half. And he's not saying much. Cornelia, of course, is doing everything under the sun. I am too, but mostly her speech therapy, play therapy, occupational therapy. And he has just 2 or 3 word sentences at that point. Well, his brother, who is one of these, siblings of folks with disabilities often grow up very fast. And his brother at 9 is already a very tough, independent kid who can handle anything the world throws at him. Except on one day a year, sometimes he gets a little emotional, his birthday. Well, we don't much notice this, but on his 9th birthday, Walt gets a teeny bit emotional, and Owen follows us into the kitchen from the backyard. We're bringing the plates and the cups, and he says to me and Cornelia, he says rather intently, "Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan."
Wow.
And it was, Marty, it was like a thunderbolt went through the kitchen. We didn't know what was happening. Owen runs off in some private reverie, and Cornelia and I just start talking to each other. We can't stop talking for 4 hours, at which point she looks at me. Now, here's a woman who is, at this point, auditioning for sainthood. She is up every night with Owen. She's running around the clock. She was a journalist like I am, but stopped doing that once the diagnosis was offered for Owen. And she's like, "Look, you know, you're the kooky one. You're the guy who dresses a clown at the birthday parties and wears the propeller hat. Find a way back in there. You can do the voices." So I go up to Owen's bedroom that night, and I grab a puppet he is very into at that point, Iago. Now, for Disney folks, any
sure.
parents, actually.
Aladdin,
that would be,
right?
That's right. That's Jafar's evil sidekick, Gilbert Gottfried. And I grab and Owen, of course, we have everything from Disney you can buy. I mean, literally, we're taking out a second mortgage to buy Disney junk. And I put the puppet, it's one of the big ones, up to my elbow. I crawl up to the side of his bed, push up the puppet. And so it's eye to eye with Owen. And I say to him in Gilbert Gottfried's voice, I say, "Owen, how does it feel to be you, to be Owen?" And he turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. And he says, "Not good. I'm lonely and I have no friends." And I just bite down hard and say, just stay in character. What would Iago say next? And I say, okay, when did you and I become friends, such good friends? And Owen says, when I watched Aladdin and you made me laugh. And we start to talk. This is our first conversation since he's two and a half. And after a few minutes, I hear him clear his throat, you know, but he's only six and a half, so it's up here like that. And he says, I love the way your foul little mind works. Now, that's Jafar. Now, at this point, you know, I just jump up and start hugging him. And we realize that Owen has memorized the dialogue. So if you throw him a line, he'll throw you back the next line, and you better be ready with the follow-up line. He can go on for an hour like this. So we start playing out scenes, all four of us, Owen and his older brother, me and Cornelia, every scene we can find from 20 Disney animated movies. This becomes what we call the basement sessions, and it goes on for years. And what's interesting, Marty, is that Owen seems not just to be reciting. He seems to be selling the lines, as an actor would say, feeling the emotions. And that gives us hope that he understood what those characters were feeling. Again, not something he's supposed to be able to do.
Well, and even going back to what he said to his brother on his birthday, that, you know, he's feeling sad like Peter Pan, that's a pretty insightful thing for a six-year-old to say, I don't care what their diagnosis is. I mean, that's a pretty brilliant observation.
Well, and exactly. That's the kind of thing that gave us hope. It was not easy to get back in, after all. You know, he wouldn't often summon zingers like that, but they would come. And they mostly would come through the dialogue with the characters. And so, you know, what we found is that in the Disney movies, now we were no great Disney fans before this, but, you know, this is the only way to reach him. So we became aficionados. And there are literally hundreds of scenes to choose from. Every available emotion is on display. Situations, you know, issues of love, of loss, of betrayal, you know, of confusion. It's just a matter of going across the classics. It's all in there.
Well, we're almost having a break here. I mean, that's what fairy tales do, don't they? I mean, they tell us about the world.
Yeah, and they have been for thousands of years. Look, the Brothers Grimm or Disney just took old folklores that human beings have been telling themselves since the dawn of time to understand themselves and make their way in the world. Owen, though, had to live on a diet of myth, fable, and legend almost exclusively. Right. And so that was quite an experiment across 20 years.
And that's Ron Suskind, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's written a new book called Life Animated, subtitled A Story of Sidekicks, Heroes, and Autism. And it's about how his son Owen developed an obsession with Disney movies. He memorized dozens of them. And it was through these animated characters and scenes that he relearned language, built social skills, and reconnected with his family. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Any questions or comments, give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY and presents the 20th Annual AIDS Education Month. Events, conferences, and workshops throughout June to increase HIV awareness and find strategies to end the AIDS epidemic. Featuring Nobel Prize winner Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, noted author and civil rights advocate Michelle Alexander, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and Grammy nominee Wale in a concert on National HIV Testing Day. All events are open to the public. More at AIDSEducationMonth.org.
The Los Angeles quartet Warpaint wouldn't call their sound dance music, but the band's hypnotic vocals and driving rhythms make holding still impossible.
We wanted to move with our music, we wanted to enjoy playing our music and have that movement and move people even if it's not outright four on the floor. Although sometimes it is.
Love is to die.
That's Warpaint singer and guitarist Emily Kokel. The band joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. That recent report on fair trade was shocking to many. We'll take a deeper look with the author.
What we found was very striking and surprising to us, which was that wages and working conditions on average were worse in the areas dominated by fair trade certified producer organizations.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ron Suskind about his new book, Life Animated, A Story of Sidekicks, Heroes, and Autism. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You write pretty early on in the book about Walt, your other son, and as you described him, he was this tough kid and looked like he could handle everything. But years later, as an adult, he said he was embarrassed by Owen, and it was probably more difficult for him than perhaps you and your wife, Cornelia, thought?
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, the part of this book is about the stories we tell ourselves to make our way. I mean, I suppose, a specialist in narrative. I've been writing stories for 30 years, but I learned a great deal about some of the stories Cornelia and I were telling ourselves, the things we wanted to hear. And it was that Walt could handle anything the world threw at him, but he wouldn't ever leave his little brother behind. And he didn't. He was always there for Owen, but we never really understood so much about what Walt was feeling. I mean, he hid it from us. He didn't want us to know. Mm-hmm. But part of this process was me having to turn to my son and treat him like a reluctant source, like someone from the White House with a classified document, and say, look, Walt, you need to tell me things that you may think I least want to hear, because otherwise this isn't going to work. And he's like, okay, you asked for it. And he was quite courageous about it, actually, and said, look, there were times where I was embarrassed by Owen. And you know, for instance, there was a story we told ourselves and told our friends about Walt, the independent adult, young adult, where he got out of the car on his first day of first grade, five blocks away from the school. He jumps out and says, I'm fine, I'll take it from here. Now, Cornelia's in the car with Owen, and she says, Walter, they know you have parents. You know, I mean, I can bring you in. And he's like, no, I'm good. That was always our story. Look at Walt. Right. Even that, he doesn't need his mother. Well, Walt explained later that he says, look, it was just me, Mom, and Owen in the car, and if she brought me in, she'd have to bring Owen in. And, you know, six-year-old boys are a pretty cruel bunch. I didn't want that to be what it was all about. What's wrong with your brother? And that's something Walt wrestled with mostly on his own, and then described later to us how he came to a kind of reconciliation. You know, as he said at one point somewhere in his late teens, it became not what if only Owen could be different, but what is, and the relationship that they have. And there's a lovely moment of transformation later. I won't spoil it for the readers. I mean, the book is full of shtick, too. Ups and downs, farce, pain. But Walter, as the sibling, is one of the most interesting of all of us, of the whole quartet. Because in some ways, readers we find connect with him as one of their own, a representative of the wider world. Remember, Walt leaves the house every morning undetected, enters the wider world, and returns at night. I mean, the parents, a kid falls in the lake, we're going to dive in. Walt, though, has choices, and the choices he makes are the crucial ones, especially in terms of how we're all defined by choices, but also in terms of the siblings. Every one of 800,000 kids in America has a brother, sister, many of them, and they're there for the whole life journey, which Walt will be for Owen.
Well, indeed. I mean, as you were describing that, I felt like that sounds like a Disney movie to me, describing Walt going out into the world, you know, as a kind of lone soldier, then coming home and dealing with his family. You also describe, Ron, going to Disney and a couple of times and seeing Owen sort of embrace these Disney characters that obviously had come to life for him, but feeling perhaps a little jealous, a little sort of cut off, like here he is embracing Winnie the Pooh, but he has a hard time making eye contact with me.
Yeah. We struggled with Disney jealousy for Disney envy. It was Disney envy. That's the clinical term,
right,
for much of our life. I mean, when we actually went to Disney, we went as Owen in his late teens got to go to the animation studios, and we actually saw the office of Walt Disney. And it was odd walking in there because we felt this jumble of emotions, almost like Walt Disney had kidnapped our kid. You know, his feelings were so strong for these characters that he had to live through and breathe through that that we often felt, you know, This guy who we don't know, who makes movies and runs theme parks, created them, is not a member of our family. But it was important because I think we understood, though, is that what these movies do is they create a verisimilitude of life, lifelike emotions through the characters, which are designed to draw the real emotions from us. And those real emotions are ones of love and family and the emotions of our home. So that's how we kind of drew the line. Owen's still ours. It's just Disney was his vehicle.
But it sounds like Disney, I mean, perhaps he had several families, and one of them was your family, Ron, but the other were these family of characters.
Well, what happened is that we inhabited those characters with him. It was our way. And once Owen becomes an aficionado of sidekicks after he's whacked. He's thrown out of a school. He's quite bruised. He's about 11 years old. He really can't express his feelings. But all of a sudden, he becomes an expert on the sidekicks. There are hundreds of them in Disney. And what we realize is that Owen, at this point, sees the wider world. He realizes that he's caught in the starting blocks. Other kids are racing forward. And he feels like a sidekick himself, not a hero. And he becomes an expert on hundreds of them. You know, the sidekicks, some are goofy, some are wise, some are confused. And he starts to live through them. He draws furiously at this point, almost like an animator. He can draw almost like the animators now. And I find a sketchbook, and the last two things he writes, kind of in a kindergartner's scrawl, he's 11, is, "I am the protector of the sidekicks." And the last thing he writes is, "No sidekick gets left behind."
Mm.
And at that point, he starts, in the cards for Mother's Day or Father's Day, he starts giving us sidekick identities. Now, Cornelia is often Big Mama from Fox and the Hound. She's the wisest and gentlest of the women sidekicks. I'm Merlin.
Well,
I'm very happy with that,
yeah,
with Merlin from
be.
Sword of the Stone. And I can do the voice, you know, "Knowledge and wisdom's the real power, my boy." And so Owen can do the voice, too. And we do that back and forth. He does Arthur, I do Merlin, then we switch. On some days, I'd be Rafiki. That was good, too.
From the Lion King, right?
From the Lion King. You know, "Wrong again. He lives in you." And, of course, Owen does these voices with such power. I had to bring up my game in terms of imitations just to match him. Interestingly, though, the only person he draws as a hero is his brother.
Uh-huh.
Only Walter is drawn as a hero for his birthdays and for Hanukkah and Christmas.
So
that was part of Owen speaking through what he turns into an emotional language.
I mean, it's such a clever way of both connecting with his family, but also expressing obviously all the emotions that he feels. I'm curious about then, if I were at your dinner table when Owen was young, what would that look like? What would that sound like?
Well, when he was young, he would probably look you over, and he would, after a time, listen, and then probably look for a sidekick for you, Marty.
I could use one.
I mean, you know, he'd probably pick well for you. You know, you're a little goofy. You're very attentive. You know, you're warm. He would find one like that. And there's so many to choose from. You often have to check the book, like, oh, I see that one.
Interesting.
That kind of works. You know, interestingly, though, at a dinner table when Owen's 14 and Walter's now 17, Owen is going on and on. Now, he's well into his sidekicks philosophy and really making sense of the word through these sidekicks and himself, is Walt challenges him. At one point, Owen's going on about the return of traditional hand-drawn animation, which, of course, he loves because he draws now like an animator. And he says, you know, to draw it, you got to feel it, and he can only feel as he draws. So, and Walt's like, look, Owen, they put out two computer-animated movies a week now. The hand-drawn stuff, that's over. But listen, if you want it to come back, you got to step up. You got to lead the charge. Now, this is the first time Owen gets challenged. We don't challenge him this way, but especially his brother. The one who's drawn as a hero. He said, "Owen, you got any movies in you? Any ideas?" And Owen kind of sits there, kind of stunned. And after a few minutes, he kind of bubbles up. You see, he gets a kind of look where he's digging in, digging deep. And he says, "Well, I do have one idea. 12 sidekicks searching for a hero. And in their journey and in the obstacles they face, each finds the hero within themselves." And that ends up being really Owen's life narrative. searching for the inner hero. And here, mind you, Marty, Owen, like a lot of kids, now he is like so many kids. Owen has a measurable IQ of 75. All right, you know, to put an IQ score on so many untraditional learners or kids with challenges like Owen, there should be a statute against that. But the fact is, people see that score for so many kids like Owen and say, the discard pile. Here's a mop until you die, and make sure you're happy. That is a loss of possibility, not just for these kids, but for all of us, of not saying, look, they're not going to be like us. They're going to be like them. Have them be more like them. Figure out a way that affinity, that passion can, in a way, become a pathway. And that's what we found. It was more pathway than prison. And that was the view for many years. And still, that these affinities, these obsessions, almost every kid on the spectrum has some. It could be Thomas the Tank Engine. It could be Disney. It could be maps or train schedules. That they are a trap, a prison. We found they really were a vehicle. Once we got in deep with him and got in without a notion of we're going to pull him out of here and we're just here to figure out a way to drag him up to sunlight, we lived down there. And eventually he showed us all that was in his underground world.
And that's Ron Suskind, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a journalist. In fact, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's currently a senior fellow at Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. And we're talking about his new book called Life Animated, A Story of Sidekicks, Heroes, and Autism. And it's about his family, his son Owen, who has been diagnosed with regressive autism, his other son Walt, and how Owen has been using Disney characters and dialogue and storyline to express himself, to connect with the world, to connect with his family as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Just picking up, Ron, on what you were just saying, because I think when we talk about someone's fascination with something, we talk about them being passionate about it. But if they have a diagnosis of autism or some kind of disability, then we call it an obsession, you know, somehow. That it's less than a passion. And it seems that Owen was, yes, obsessed with Disney, but he had a deep passion for it, too.
It's so insightful, Marty. Look, to draw the line between passion and obsession, boy, that's a tricky line to draw.
Sure.
But because the specific challenge of these kids is they can't jump around. They're not generally interested in things as many people are. That's their specific malady, if you will. Of course, almost anything they fix on is going to be seemingly to the exclusion of everything else. And that's, I think, a bit of the blind spot we've had in the so-called neurotypical community, whatever that means, over many, many years. And I think what the book is doing and research that is emerging from the book is changing that. It's reversing the telescope. And right now, MIT and Yale, Cambridge University, Duke, and even folks at NIH are talking about looking at these affinities in a new way and understanding the mechanism that drives these intense, deep areas of focus. And the notion is this, and it's in the book in this way. We called it affinity therapy. Originally, we called it Disney therapy. But there are several and many affinities, probably 20 of them, that are the major affinities that a lot of these kids embrace in this period, whatever's out there now in the popular culture often, the affinity, if you focus on it, and they're thinking of now they're going to do fMRIs to see what mechanisms fire in the brains of these kids, it can lead you to understanding underlying capabilities that might be otherwise invisible that might then lead to better possibilities once they're harnessed in the lives of these kids, which is, of course, better for everyone. And that's the very hopeful part that the book has spurred.
Indeed. Let me get to Gary from Malvern, Pennsylvania, to join us. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
I'm a senior citizen who was diagnosed with on the autistic scale in the 1990s. I'm high function Asperger's.
Yeah.
The thing that I think I heard this that the idea of an obsession being a bad thing in my case was a wonderful thing because it led me in a path that eventually I had a normal life. Yeah. In the beginning, one of the things I want to point out about me as an autistic, I can't speak for others, is how I was affected and am affected by sensory sensitivity. It's not that I didn't want to deal with the world. It was so painful. And I think many autistics are in the same way. We want to deal with the world, but we have to have some structure, some way to get around it. Because from what I gather from when I talk to other people, I don't think like other people.
That's interesting, Gary. I'm looking at the computer screen here saying that, like Owen, what brought you out were things like movies and animals. So there's an interesting parallel story here.
Yeah.
Ron, go ahead. It sounds like you want to add something.
Well, Gary is a kind of proof of concept. I meet a lot of Garys at different ages. Frankly, many not senior citizens, but kids, young adults of all ages who are coming up at book signings and saying, well, here's my thing. Or parents are of little kids. You know, one came up the other day, said, my kid's into black and white movies from the 40s and 50s. I'm like, plenty to work with there. And another friend of ours, a researcher, was talking about his kid being a map kid. And he says, look, I wish he was a Disney kid, you know, thinking that would be better. But then we start to talk about maps. And this is a kid who memorizes 12, the Rand McNally World Atlas, the whole thing. And so what are maps? Well, they're the two-dimensional rendering of all humanity. Every town and every map is a story that goes down 1,000 feet. It's the way we place ourselves in the world. There's so much to work with there if you can think about how to speak map. So this father then starts to tell me, well, look, of late, my son is starting to draw imaginary maps that are mapping his emotional landscape.
Wow.
That's the same exact thing. And what we're trying to do is help people see this so that they can see not just people like Gary, but, 2 million people in America, 2.5% of the male population for children with maybe what Proust would call new eyes and thereby new possibilities, to not say, look, I'm going to make you more like the typical kid and do anything short of murder to do that. And essentially, in that square peg, round hole battle, shave off all those edges that are often their best stuff. Gary sounds like he preserved his best stuff and turned it into a life. And that's really admirable.
Indeed. Gary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation with Ron Suskind. Again, we're talking about his new book. It's called Life Animated, A Story of Sidekicks, Heroes, and Autism. It's a story about his family, his wife, his son, Owen, who was diagnosed with regressive autism when he was just about 3 years old, and about Owen's brother, Walt, a couple of years older. And it's how Owen essentially taught his family how to communicate using Disney characters. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
On the next Fresh Air, Denzel Washington and LaTanya Richardson Jackson. They're co-starring on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun. Washington plays the role originated by Sidney Poitier, who he went to for advice.
He was funny because he was like, I'm not going to tell you what to do. And then he'd start trying to remember lines.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We We all talk about how stress is contagious, but now we're even learning that we can get it from a TV monitor. A new study has found that even watching someone under stress can cause it in us. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk with the author of that study and others about what we can do to keep from taking in contagious stress. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Get Healthy Philly, an initiative of the Philadelphia Health Department, supports WHYY. Cigarette butts are one of the most polluted items in the world. Help keep your parks, recreation centers, and playgrounds smoke-free and butt-free. Details at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or smokefreephilly.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Ron Suskind about his new book, Life Animated. And if you want to see a video of Ron and his son Owen in conversation, we posted one on our Facebook page. You can go to whyy.org/radiotimes and, in a sense, kind of see what it is that we have been talking about on the air. We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Ron, you do admit the fact that your family has some wherewithal, you have a Pulitzer Prize, you're a pretty well-known journalist, that has helped you to get the kind of help that Owen needed in order to be the kind of person that he is.
Yeah, there's no doubt that we basically spent every cent we had, and we were gathering enough money to invest, I suppose is the word, $80,000-$90,000 a year in some years in Owen's therapies and medical stuff and schooling. It costs about $60,000 a year, according to Autism Speaks, to school and educate, give therapy and support to an autistic spectrum kid. All of that is crucial, and that's why, insurance companies need to pay for autism therapies, and kids need to get to schools which are going to do what they need. But having said that, I think what we found at the end of the day is the most important element in this mix was what you'd call sweat equity. And we're mindful of the fact that Cornelia stopped working outside of the home when Owen was diagnosed, and many moms or dads can't have that. They can't have just one earner. But a lot can, and that ends up being the most important part of this, is that we just spent endless hours with them. And again, very much like other parents, we're just like a zillion other parents of kids on the spectrum. I think what we stumbled into with a lot of trial and error, mostly error, was this kind of way that was working that we find now works with lots of kids. Owen now runs Disney Club at this college program he's about to graduate from. Well, there's 35 kids in the room, many of them very similar to Owen. They were not raised in a household like ours, inventing or creating this affinity therapy, but they've come to it quickly. And over the last 3 years since Owen started Disney Club, parents tell us their kids are racing forward. It's almost like a dam break or a key unlocking, a reserve of their identity, ways to express emotion. They all were obsessed with Disney. Many of them were told, turn it off, it's not age appropriate, or don't do that while people are around. Or it was turned into a behavioral tool, which, again, we tried too. Which
like is reward you watch or punishment, that kind of thing?
You bet. You want to watch your favorite video? Here's 10 things you'll need to do, each like walking across hot coals. When we tried that, it would get a little spike of positive behaviors, where he would stop doing self-stimulatory stuff or talking to himself, but it would fade almost immediately. It's like we were cutting off his supply lines. Mm. And after a while, we said, you got to go with it. And that's where the real breakthroughs happen.
You also found what sounds like a very sensitive, insightful therapist, a guy named Dan Griffin. And there's a scene in here where he makes a contract with Owen using Zazu, who's another character from The Lion King, as a way, as you write, of Owen sort of teaching Zazu things so that Owen can learn things for himself. A very clever, creative resolution, it seems.
Yeah, Dan is a terrific guy and a great doctor therapist, and he jumped across the divide when most of our team was saying, no, this is perseverative or obsessive, try to cut it off or use it as a tool. Dan's like, I'm just going to jump in. And once he does that, all sorts of good things start to happen because Cornelia and I now have a real professional like in the underground cavern with us. And he starts to use the sidekicks we all do together and the other characters in all sorts of ways that was, frankly, much of it was joyous. Owen responded so strongly to solving problems for Zazu that he couldn't, in a way, solve for himself. And then we see what's happening is he's developing something, and I don't want to get clinical or here, but it's called inner speech. There's a guy named Vygotsky, who's a Russian psychologist and researcher who came up with this. And everyone understands this. When you're 2 years old, you verbalize everything. I want this, and I'm going here. Around 3 years old, most of us develop this inner speech, which is like talking to yourself, thinking things through so you don't mess up. It grows into executive function eventually. Autistic kids are not supposed to have this. It's seen as one of the great barriers to their progress. Owen developed inner speech in talking to his characters under his breath, in his head. Once we saw that, we could start to manipulate the characters to set up conversations. And then he was doing it himself. It was just wonderful. He was starting to advise himself in the voices of the wise sidekicks. And just, there's that scene where we ask him to solve a problem for a boy like him, Dan does, at our behest, in the voice of Rafiki, one of the wise sidekicks. Owen, without skipping a beat, says, "I would prefer Merlin." And Dan's like, "Great, then Merlin." Owen goes right into it. He was starting to regress. He had been whacked by some bullies. And Owen starts in the voice of Merlin. He usually starts with a line from the movie in the voice. So he says, "You know, knowledge and wisdom's the real power, my boy." And then he says, "You know, I turned you into a fish. Remember that? Now, the future, you see, boy, is like that water. You've got to swim. Mm. You can't go backwards. You've got to go forwards." Now, Dan looks at me in the therapy session and says, "Is that in the movie?" And I'm shaking my head. No, that's all fresh dialogue that he imputed and improvised using Merlin's voice. Owen was self-healing. Now, the crazy part, Marty, is it's happening in Disney Club with 30 kids.
Wow.
Right now, they're doing the same thing.
Well, I'm looking at this contract for educating Zazu. I, Owen, Harry Susskind, agree to undertake the challenging but critical task of providing simulating educational experiences for my good friend Zazu. And the list is life in the world, how to concentrate, following directions, health, asking questions, making friends, fun, loving people, science, and helping others. And it's all signed, and I think you signed, and Dan Griffin signed as well. But and it worked?
Yeah. It worked.
Wow.
It worked. And you could actually then talk to him about those issues through the character. And you know, it's interesting because this is part of what we call building a vehicle, where Owen started with us to construct a vehicle that he now drives out into the world of sunlight. And what's nice about Disney, to be specific about Disney, is that everyone has seen these movies. So it's kind of a lingua franca, shared language, that then folks can engage with as well. What's lovely about it, too, is that there's a lovely comparative quality here, that you or I might have seen these movies, and people would say, "Well, how is it that I don't see in Dumbo what he sees, and he has a 75 IQ? What's wrong with that equation?" Well, it's the number, or it's the way we reduce expectations and a sense of what's possible for so many kids who have these very narrow and very deep affinities that they're using like the Enigma machine in World War II, like the code breaker to make sense of the world.
Let me get Roy from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Roy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi,
it's very kind of you to take my call.
Oh, absolutely.
I am the father of a 24-year-old nonverbal son with autism and epilepsy, and he also is passionate about Disney and Thomas the Tank Engine. And we haven't had the kind of breakthrough that you describe in your book, which I have a copy of and is wonderful. But I just wanted to make the general point that there isn't any ongoing forum or context for educating adults with autism and with an inspired point of view of trying to, with the insights that you describe, at least in the Philadelphia area. And I wonder if your book and the radio show might be a call to action to educators and therapists that even as adults our kids are lifelong learners, and there are ways of getting in there, maybe not the same for every child, but not to give up.
Sure.
And I'll stop there.
No, Roy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ron Suskind, go ahead.
No, thank you, Roy. First off, I think the you know this, Roy, but the listeners may not know, but I think about 40% of kids on the autism spectrum are either nonverbal or almost nonverbal. And we know many kids like that, and they all have a very similar profile as to their affinities. They may not be able to express it, but some can with augmentative devices where they type or touch symbols. But I think, Roy, you're right. They are in there, and they are, in a way, demanding a richer life. There is not an organized structure right now, but one is growing to study these affinities and to help them in advancing therapy. And we're at the center of that. We have a lifeanimated.net site. We're building a YouTube channel where some of these affinities and how they're expressed and the capabilities they express are being displayed. There's several researchers that I'm working with that are saying, we want to move forward. I think what you're going to find is it's going to start sprouting in many cities. It already is around the country. And I think the important point, Roy, you make is that many of our impressions, certainly the world's impressions of kids, either like yours or mine, though they seem very different from each other on this wide autism spectrum, are not really accurate. Cornelia has... My wife says, look, you know, part of what we found is respect their affinity, even if they can speak and they feel it. It's respecting them. Their identities get woven tightly to these ideas, these affinities, these passions. And that's something they feel. And their life, their inner life, is often quite rich, even if we can't get into it.
Roy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think lifelong learning is something we should all embrace and be thinking about. Let me get Tammy from New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tammy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
And I'm so happy that I came upon this conversation. I have a son who has autism, and I have a son whose name is Walter.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh. Tammy, how's that? Do we know each other?
Yeah, really. Go ahead, Tammy.
Well, the situation is not exactly the same, but, you know, Walter has grown up with my son and has had signs of sensitivity and times not, but he wants to pursue dealing and helping handicapped people as he grows up. And I was wondering what your Walter, or he says he does, but I was wondering what your Walter is doing with his life.
That's a good question, wow. Tammy. Yeah, go ahead, Ron Suskind.
Wow. That's astonishing, Tammy. My Walter is right now working for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. That's the new agency that Elizabeth Warren started, helping people who are preyed upon, financial predation. But I think Walter has urges that are not all that different from your Walter. You know, he's a very feeling, open guy who, you know, gets involved in lots of social work, is very embracing of this current role he has as a very noteworthy sibling. He's out on the road. He's giving speeches. He's there with us on the panels and the interviews. He said something interesting. I'll just throw this out.
Sure.
I think you'll like this. Is that we're at a speech in Washington, and someone asked a question of Walt, and it was a room that was crowded with folks, including some therapists that Owen had and some old teachers that he had. And Walter says, you know, look, the first thing we played in the basement sessions was the Jungle Book. And, of course, Dad was Baloo. Mom was Bagheera, the protective panther. I was King Louie. And Owen was Mowgli. And really, over 20 years, Walt said, we've been trying to get Owen to the man village.
Oh, wow.
And he's almost there now. He's going to have a better life than we thought. And all of you have been part of that here in the room. And that's quite profound. And Cornelia and I were sitting there in the stage like, oh my, what
crying,
the devil?
Probably.
We were. I mean, you know, after all these years with Disney, I had never thought of that one. Mm-hmm. And nor had Cornelia. But I think that's a very hopeful. And when Walter was recently asked about his brother, he said, look, I see someday I'll be 70, he'll be 68. I'll probably live near him. I hope I will. and I'll be there for him, you know, because we are brothers forever.
Tammy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Ron, I mean, how do you then think about Owen's future without you?
Well, there's a part of The Lion King that Owen recites word for word, has for years, where Mufasa says to young Simba, Simba, look at the stars. The kings of old will look down upon you. Whenever you're lonely or afraid, look to them. They will guide you. And I think that someday Cornelia and I will be there. And Owen will look to the stars. And he has many, many powerful stories that will shape him through his life. And they're the stories we've always used, all of us, to shape ourselves. And that's why we're not as concerned about his future as we once were. Of course, we have concerns. He's autistic. He'll be autistic his whole life. It's not a spell that's broken. It's a way of being. But he's finding his way in the world.
We're almost out of time here. Has Owen made you a better person?
Better than I deserve to be.
Really?
I think it's Cornelia's line. He forced us to give up some of our vanities and our pride and our foolishness. He lives very much in the moment, so he did that too for us. And in some ways, as Owen says, you know, the highest praise, the highest character status is a sidekick who helps others fulfill their destiny, helps the hero fulfill his destiny. And on each day, the best days, he says, you find that inner hero. So that's what our life's about.
Well, Ron Suskind, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. It really is an extraordinary story.
Oh, thank you, Marty. Really fun.
You're welcome. Fun for us as well. And again, the book is called Life Animated, A Story of Sidekicks, Heroes, and Autism. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And as I said, we posted on our Facebook page a video of Ron and his son, Owen Suskind, in conversation. You can also send us an email and check out the podcasts and archives and Twitter as well, and how to listen to Radio Times on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant with Sophie Reed. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for those phone calls as well. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.